Miss Farnborough, Reel 16.
Whom he had known and I had met. And I remember him saying, I said, Batushka, do you think it was all in vain? All the misery and the suffering and the bloodshed in vain. And he said, that is a very difficult question to answer. Because you know, Sestrica, there are two sides to warfare. There is that dreadful, deadly, savage side when man must kill man at any price, regardless of the pain he's inflicting. And there is... I was just going to tell you. Yeah. And he said, there is that savage side of war, which is unforgivable, but it is warfare. But don't forget, there is another side. I have seen it myself, and you must have seen it too, many, very often, how there are among these soldiers such self-abnegation, such a spirit of self-sacrifice, that many of them will go to no matter what ends in order to save the life of a comrade. He said, I have seen young soldiers crawl across the field in full the view of the enemy to pull a comrade to safety. And he said, there is that extraordinary new type of heroism which is born of the savagery of warfare. He said, you can never get away from that. And he said, then too, I am quite convinced that those young men who go out there and willingly give up their young lives for the sake of their country, for the sake of their Tsar, for the sake of their God, knowing they are doing the right thing, I firmly believe that they will receive life again at the hands of God.
Did you worry about how God could let a war like that happen?
No, one doesn't. One doesn't ask when some great catastrophe happens. One doesn't ask why or who caused it. Perhaps one does after some days. I think in a time of great disaster, the great thing is to go to help those who are suffering because of the disaster. We knew that war was the worst thing that could happen. I don't remember, very long ago, I remember Winston Churchill quoting a very lovely thing. I don't know whether I can remember it. It was something like this. They say that war is hell, the great accursed, the sin impossible to be forgiven. And yet I look beyond it at its worst and still find blue in heaven. I'm glad I remembered that. And there again, all the courage, all the tremendous self-sacrifice, and all that marvelous, undaunted spirit of our soldiers was the blue in heaven.
Actually, all the Russians were not Christians, were they? They were Muslims
as well. Oh, no. They were drawn from all the different states known now in the Soviet Union as the federal states, which make up the united, the Soviet, you see, socialist governments. Never government, governments. Because each Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Azerbaijan, and the Kyrgyz, they all have their own governments. They all have, but they are all under the main government of the Soviet Union. But that is why it is the USSR, the Union of the Socialist Republics. We had to always ask the Tatars. They are Muslims. And they would not agree. And I think probably that story's left in my book. There were many others. But this story told how this old Muslim refused, categorically refused, to have his leg amputated, despite the fact that our surgeon pointed out that he would surely die if the leg, which was showing signs of gangrene, were not amputated within a few hours. But he said, no, if Allah wishes, I will die. And he didn't. And I think I remember mentioning in my book, I was at the deathbed of more than one, and they were always ready to die. A marvelous spirit. There again, the blue in heaven.
Yes, I remember that story from your book.
But there were many others. And I remember once an old Tatar was brought to us, and he couldn't speak Russian very well. He was begging, pleading with his arms, you know, something to be done. So we called quickly another elderly Tatar who was our driver, because we had mostly of our drivers. They were very brave, capable, dutiful men. And we called him to see, but they couldn't find him. And when he came, it was too late. And we said, listen, ask him questions. But he couldn't answer. And the old man was so affected, he went away wiping his eyes. He knew perfectly well that had he been able, he might have had a message for some family or a few words of farewell.
Why did you have Tatar drivers?
Well, we took them from all over the country. The Tatar drivers whom our Red Cross unit engaged were men of really beyond the warring age. They were men probably around 40 or 50. But they were still hale and hearty and very, very strong and excellent drivers. And we relied on them in many critical moments, and they never let us down. Never. I have a great admiration for them. And another thing, I have seen Tatar drivers in our Red Cross unit starve, practically starve, rather than eat the food given them to the Russian Orthodox rank and file. And you see, they would never dream of having pig, and never dream of having meat at any certain seasons when they are fasting, you know. And they might be terribly hungry, but it made no difference. They could hold out with marvelous strength of mind and will.
Did they prepare their own food to make sure it was done in the correct
No,
way?
I think there were certain kitchens that were set apart for them. We had what they called the mobile kitchen. You've probably seen photographs of it on wheels with a great big thing like an urn and with a chimney. And there that would be lighted underneath. The smoke would go through the chimney and the contents of the great urn would be slowly heated and boiled. Especially if it was soup. And I saw our cook making soup one day. He filled the urn with water. And in it he flung all kinds of vegetables, leaves and everything, cauliflower, the cabbage, anything he could get. And then he had a goat. And he cut up the goat and threw pieces of it into the... Of course it was skinned, I'm hoping it was washed. Threw pieces of goat into the urn too, and then the fires were lit. And that would make excellent soup. One never knew exactly what the green stuff was that was in the soup, but it was very savoury. Onions, of course, were in great request. The men loved onions. Very often they could eat a whole onion raw. And with a bit of bread, you know, black bread and an onion, they were happy. But they had their meals at specified times. They knew exactly. A kind of gong would be rung. And there they would go. All you hear the tins clanking. The little tins that they had fastened to their belt. And then they would go to these mobile kitchens, and there the cook or cook's assistants would ladle out great spoonfuls of the boiling stuff inside the urns. And sometimes it looked very good. Once or twice I was invited to have some. I remember once I went with some friends to see a regiment, and they were preparing dinner for the soldiers. And of course the soldiers were all lined up, ready to receive their rations. So of course the sestrista Anglichanka must try our ration. So they gave me a bowl and they put a good ladle of soup in it. And it was so delicious, I'd had it right to the last drop. And what is more, I drank it, what was left, and I spooned it out. No, I don't think they gave me a spoon for that, but I had a piece of bread which I dipped in the soup. And then when it was wet and hot, I would eat the bread and then dip it on. And then anything that was left, I just drank it out wholesale. The soldiers were delighted. They thought I would graciously accept just a little spoonful and be satisfied. But I had it all and loved it every minute. I think I was very hungry. Probably if they'd offered me a second bowlful, I would have accepted.
I think one time you wrote you even had earwig soup.
Oh, yes. That was when we were in a forest and the trees were literally infested. And you know, you couldn't get them away. Naturally, anything that was open, they dropped into it. So when it was being ladled out, there was soup with insects, with earwigs. And when we were sitting under the trees, they would drop down on us and into our soup. It was nothing unusual, but we knew that it was real earwig soup.
What's the Russian word for earwig?
For the earwig, dear. Oh, now you've asked me. Don't think that if you told me I should know whether it were right or wrong. But don't remember, 60 long years have passed. And I do feel that perhaps it's my own fault. I have so many beautiful Russian books, but I seldom, if ever, read them. I think, although I'm supposed to be retired, life is still very intense, and there isn't a day that I regret that I haven't filled sufficiently, because there are so many other things to do, so many other occupations.
You said that the outstanding characteristics of the Russian soldier were his patience and endurance.
And I'm glad you remember that.
Are they different then from other people that you've known? Is that what you meant by that?
Well, they are different in this way, because other people I've seen in time of peace. But I'm speaking of the soldiers in time of war. I don't think anyone could compete with them for their patience and long-suffering. I think it may be because most of them were drawn from the peasant class. The officers were, of course, educated men, but the rank and file was composed chiefly of the peasant country class, country worker. And they, in a strange way, had always been accustomed to fighting against odds, to be challenged for their happiness and their welfare. So it was no real hardship for them to stand up against something which they had to bear patiently, and perhaps which hurt them, and they would have to also accept it, because they were suffering for Matushka Russia, for Mother Russia.
I assume that there were some men who were not able to be patient and enduring. What did you do, for instance, about shell shock?
We had no instances of that. If there were any people who were whole in limb and body, and were their minds had gone, they were passed on straight away. Don't forget, we were a surgical field unit.